Welcome to Ufahamu Africa. I'm Rachel Beatty-Riedel, one of your hosts, along with my co-host Kim Yi Dion. This week, we are sharing part two of a conversation between fellow Mamba Ndiaye and journalist Barso Tal. If you haven't yet, check out last week's episode for the first part of their discussion on the political events happening in Senegal. Then come back for this episode where they continue the conversation about charges against political opponent Ousmane Sonko and the political uprisings happening in the country. A note to listeners, there will be a discussion of sexual assault allegations in this episode, so please listen with care. The episode will also be our closing discussion of season 7. Thanks so much to our non-resident fellows for their great contributions this season, to Carnegie Corporation for their support, and to you, the listeners, for following along. Don't forget to follow us on social media at Ufahamu Africa, and for updates about next season and bonus episodes, you can also check out our website, ufahamuafrica.com. Now, here's our episode with Bamba and Barso.
Greetings, folks, and welcome back to the podcast. I am your host, Bamba. I am also the Ufahamu Africa podcast non-resident fellow, and I have the pleasure to come back for another installment for the fellowship, and this time we will be talking about the protest movement in Senegal. And my guest today is none other than Barso Tal, freelance journalist in Senegal, Chevening scholar, and she will be discussing with us the recent uprising in Senegal. Barso, it is a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Thank you, Bamba, and hello, everyone.
Now, very important things happened inside that courtroom, and we have to thank people like Fala Fleur for updating us. And one thing that came out was the statement of Dr. Gay, who was the gynecologist who consulted Ajisar on the day of the supposed rape. And the day after the trial, one of the main newspapers in the country reported that there were traces of sperm that were taken and analyzed. And that was according to the gynecologist, Dr. Al-Fusein Gay. And then the same day, the doctor came out. This was on May 24th, with a written statement in which he denied saying those things that the newspaper, L'Observateur, so L'Observateur is the name of the newspaper, and it is a newspaper owned by singer and songwriter Youssou N'Dour, who is very close to the regime. And I want to just read a couple of paragraphs, short paragraphs from the statement. And it goes as follows. It's in French, but bear with me. Suite aux propos relayés dans la presse, on m'attribue les propos d'audience selon lesquels j'aurais confirmé la présence de spermatozoïdes dans les prélèvements de Ajisar lors de son premier examen gynécologique réalisé le 2 février 2021. Je tiens à apporter les précisions ci-après. D'abord, un spermatozoïde n'est pas visible à l'œil nu, donc un examen physique ne peut en aucune façon en établir la présence et encore moins en conclure à leur état de mort ou vivant. And the statement continues. So he's basically saying that there is a newspaper that is putting stuff in my mouth, saying that I said in court that there were, when I performed the exam, traces of sperm, and none of that happened. If I can summarize the statement. Now, as a journalist, who, like you mentioned earlier, fake news has been quite prolific,
sharing the space,
right? Throughout the case, but also for the last couple of years when it comes to Sonko Ajisar. What do you think of that? Why are there so many fake news around the case to a point that, you know, somebody like Dr. Gaye will have to come and make precisions and, you know, deny the allegations from the media. So as a journalist, what do you think of that? And how should we combat the proliferation of fake news?
Your question exposes me to sort of have a certain view of local journalists here, which I try to avoid because there is a reality that I might not fully grasp that they face themselves when it comes to covering the news. And I try to also respect the, you know, just the whole corporation. But there is a fact that next to the truth, or next to what is proven to be the truth, there is a lot of fake news. And that, unfortunately, many of the newspapers try to, in the, I think it's in a, just in a concern to share breaking news. I think that's how I want to view it. You know, just wanting to share breaking news, they may not take the time to fully check or double check what the news are. Of course, it's obvious that some outlets are also in favor of one party over the other. It is quite obvious. But I would like to focus on the fact that fake news are very close to truth, but the truth always comes out again. If it's not the journalist showing it, it's the internet, the people online showing it, whether they're in Senegal or in the diaspora, you understand? Mm-hmm. And just like you were mentioning about the medical certificate from the doctor, there was, technically, there's only one. And that's of Dr. Alfousseini Gaye, who stated on that document that there is no proof of sperm coming from or belonging to Sonko. And that was key in this case. But that said, there was also another document that came out saying that, you know, the sperm could belong to Ousmane Sonko. Just to say that, you know, it's easy to make a document. Yeah. It's easy to forge. It's very easy to forge nowadays. It's a very easy, signatures are out there, you know, names are out there. It's very easy to have a document multiplied and given another version, you know. But the fascinating, again, the fascinating part in this whole process is that next to that fake news, the person who can address the truth can make a video and talk about the truth. And that's what Dr. Alfousseini Gaye did. You know, he quickly debunked that fake news and just said, this was not me, this was not my signature, this was not my conclusion, and that I remain constant in the fact that, I'm quoting him, in the fact that, you know, I only, I did not see anything from Sonko or belonging to Sonko, right? You know that there were so many other documents, just no, not even documents, just news just passing by very quickly on social media. Yes. So as journalists, to come back to that role we play of fact-checking, we have to be very careful about what we share, about how we share it, and also pay attention to the audience that we have, you know, because everyone is following.
Yeah.
And I mean, fake news is just, we just have to live with it. We just have to live with it. There's nothing we can do about it. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is important, that precision, because for 2 years since the case started, people, especially from the government or who are close to the regime, came out on TV, radio, social media, telling us that the exam found traces of sperm, but also telling us that there were videos and all those stuff. So all that misinformation was being circulated. We saw that the past week during the protest or the uprising, a lot of fake news coming from some of the people on social media. I wouldn't say they protested, but this was mostly things you would see on social media. For instance, they were talking about, RTS, the TV station, the national TV station, is burning. Calling people to go towards FTS and things like that. But it was totally fake, right? But that also in itself could fuel more violence in this
I mean,
context?
In the role that we play as media people, media professionals, I think one of the first things is to remain calm in the face of everything that happens, and just make sure that we have the right information, and we need to double check and not fully focus on what we see online and consider that as news. We have access to people. We can talk to people. We can interview them very quickly. It takes a minute if you have the contact to call somebody and say, you know, an authorized voice, of course, of whatever agency we are seeking, to talk and ask very quickly. In today's world, with the technologies that we have, with the, you know, possibilities that people have to debunk any fake news, it's just requiring patience and just be able to jump into opportunities when they come, while being extra careful, because if you have one truth, you have five fake news.
Now, all of those things happen mm-hmm. during the trial inside the courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
But the verdict finally came out a week after the trial. So on June 1st. Mm-hmm. And it mm-hmm. was a very quick verdict. I think the whole thing lasted mm-hmm. 20 minutes. The judge came mm-hmm. and said Sonko was guilty of corrupting the youth.
Mm-hmm.
The rape charges and the death threat charges were dropped. Basically, the verdict says that there was no rape, there was no death threat. And unfortunately, it confirmed what many, many, many people, not to say the majority, knew all along, that this could be an outcome of a political conspiracy orchestrated by people who were close to the regime. After the verdict, right after, I think maybe a couple of hours after, violence erupted in Dakar and Ziguinchor, but quickly
mm-hmm.
it spread
mm-hmm.
across the country. And mm-hmm. unfortunately, several people died. Officially, the official numbers given by the government was 16. But after mm-hmm. the official numbers given, which was maybe mm-hmm. last week, so this was mm-hmm. after 2 days of uprising, of protests, 16 people were mm-hmm. officially reported dead. But Amnesty mm-hmm. International came
exactly.
out
mm-hmm.
and gave a different count.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
the opposition also, including PASEF, gave also a different mm-hmm. count. Amnesty says 23 mm-hmm. people were killed during the protests.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them mm-hmm. were shot and killed mm-hmm. by either the police or the armed militia that we call Nervi. We discussed the mm-hmm. Nervi on my podcast, but
yes.
we can explain, you know, who they are later. Because there was also mm-hmm. another instance when the national police came out on TV to denounce mm-hmm. the protesters, saying that they were armed, you know, they were using firearms and things, and showed pictures and videos. But quickly, like you said, the magic of internet users fact-checked the statement of the police and the video and debunked their statement and the narrative that they were trying to vehicle. But in addition to that, the international media, Al Jazeera in particular and France 24, also did the same fact-checking exercise and debunked the narrative of the police. Those videos that they showed were not protesters. Those people were working alongside the police. And this has been a serious problem since the advent of Macky Sall in power. People who are super close to him have mm-hmm. invested millions to buy pickups and weapons to give to civilians in order to attack protesters and break protest movements. And it's a serious problem.
That is the news that's very much circulating for the past few weeks. But before we get to that,
mm-hmm.
allow me to go back to the court decision and how it went from a two-year-long case of rape to a decision of youth corruption. you know, to convict Sonko. That it's very important to come back to that.
Yes.
Because I think Ajisar was under 21 when the when she accused Sonko of rape. And in that specific case, and in the absence of proof to convict Sonko of rape, okay, after 2 years of accusations and even death threat, the judge just removed all the accusations and instead placed another law that would help convict Sonko, and that is youth corruption.
Another charge. Sonko was sentenced for something he was not charged of, basically, or
at the very
of.
Beginning. But the judge has that ability to seek another. I mean, he's the judge, you know. He can see other things that maybe were not put on the table at the very beginning. And so, at the very beginning, like you're mentioning just now, rape and threat,
death
threat was on the table. At the end of it, with no proof, even if the lawyers were not there to speak on behalf of Sonko because he was absent, there was absolutely no proof of those two charges, which ended up being dropped. And just, I think the penal code, and I know that the penal code under the Article 324, okay, has this paragraph in the Article 324 that pretty much explains how the debaucherie was found, or the corruption of youth was found in this context. So Ajisar was under 21 when she accused Sonko of rape. And so in that context, Sonko was the adult and Ajisar was the younger person. And whoever sort of destroys or disturbs the morals, or, you know, corrupts the moral of a young person in a sexual way can be sentenced to 2 to 5 years, and even have a fine of, I think, between 300,000 to 4 million. I'm just reading now. That's what I was searching, just to be precise. So Article 324, paragraph 2 of the Penal Code punishes with penalties whoever makes an attack on morals by executing, favoring, or facilitating debauchery or the corruption of youth of either sex, whether you're a boy or a girl, at the age of under 21. Different from the Article 320 of the same penal code, which concerns minors under the age of 13. So there is a difference in the codes that are used, and the one used in favor of Ajisar to convict Sonko was 324. And in that context, Sonko was convicted of 2 years instead of five, which is the maximum sentence. 2 years is the minimum. 2 years in jail and a fine of, I think he was given 600,000 sefa. That's still a lot of money. He was given 600,000 to give, but that's less, much less than what Ajisar was asking.
Yes.
You know, much, much less. And that, you know, as a woman analyzing this with you, it hurts. But putting my emotions aside, because it's always, you know, rape is something very, very sensitive, you know. And so to see a person accusing someone, a woman particularly, and this takes 2 years to be concluded. More than 20 people died from the moment of the accusations, you know, because it people fought at the time in 2021 to protect Sonko. You know, other people fought to protect Ajisar. So it was this whole process we went through as Senegalese people and as the diaspora, just watching all these things take place to come to an end and see that no rape was happening, never happened. There was no rape, okay? There was no death threat. And to come back to this conclusion of youth, of corrupting youth, it completely weakens women's rights. And that's what is painful in the process as a woman watching this happen, because women now, and I mentioned it in 2020 when in 2021 when the case first arose to the public, I mentioned it in co-writing in the Washington Post it was important to highlight the fact that this risked silencing from other victims of sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? And we've seen it this year. We've seen it. As we were trying to figure out whether Sonko was guilty or not of rape, and as the results came out and people were fighting to protect him or protect his eligibility for the presidentials in 2024, as all this is happening, there's a man out there who is now identified and who is, I think he is even arrested, or yeah, I think he's arrested,
mm-hmm.
who raped more than 27. At first they said 27, and now they're bringing it over to 35,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, or even more. Young women.
Young girls, yes.
You see what I'm saying? So this whole rape case just covers everything else that is truly also going on in the country.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And when women see, imagine younger people see Ajisa Sonko as a fake rape case. Fake meaning, at the end of the day, at the end of 2 years, actually, the judge decides that this there was no rape and mm-hmm. there was no death threat. What will that woman who goes through real sexual assault feel?
Mm-hmm.
But given the situation, given the context and how it all unfolded, to this day, women are at risk of not being heard
mm-hmm.
when sexual assault hits them.
Mm-hmm.
And that is another very unfortunate outcome of this rape case that actually was concluded as a youth corruption.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? And again, the youth corruption is very clear in the penal code. It's very clear. And given that Ajisa was under the age of 21 at the time of the rape or the allegations of rape, and given that Sonko was the adult at the time, and even surprised that they did not find him for getting out of his house during COVID, you know what I mean? I thought that was going to be a part of it, part of the sentencing. Just to tell you that anything could have been, you know, found in this case just to convict him.
Yeah. Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Because it was during COVID time. It was during 2020. It was during the COVID that he was said to have stepped out of his house to benefit from Ajisa's massage skills. So it was during COVID. And given the curfew, there was a fine, you know, if you are caught.
Because he was an MP, he had an immunity. He could leave.
Yes.
Technically, without any problem. Even if he was arrested, his status as an MP gave him the right to leave, to come and go. Just like doctors and people who are essential workers. So that made
him... Yes, at the time he was an MP, so that made him more...
an essential...
Protected.
Exactly.
Yes, I agree. But I'm just making that highlight, probably because anything could have... I mean, had that not been the case, they would have probably used it against him.
Yeah.
Because everything was tried, you know, to put a sentence on him.
Yeah.
So the, you know, the whole rape case... it was very unfortunate to hear so many, I mean, no children, no even younger person, when we consider morals, okay, should have been in court at that time when the lawyers were talking, you know, and just basic, complete disrespect to women, you know, talking as if it was just objects. I'm just crying all this out. And just getting away from my journalist, you know, side, simply because it hits hard to see all the heritage that we received as women in this country to fight for our rights, to see them just weakened by a rape case that did not exist at the end of 2 years of fight and a lot of hurt in the process to the populations.
Yeah.
All right. And to Sonko's family.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it became clear, like I said, to many of us, that Senegalese, that this was politically motivated. And now the question is, what is going to happen to Ajisar and to Sonko, because Ajisar was not satisfied, so she appealed today.
She appealed. Yeah, we're just Nehadi, waiting for that.
Yes,
yeah.
Nehadi, nobody's satisfied with the verdict. Sonko is not satisfied with it. Nehadi mm-hmm. also appealed at the beginning of this week. So we
because
will
she was also sentenced.
Yeah, to 2 years.
Yes.
So mm-hmm. you know, so we will see how all of this will unfold. Okay.
Yeah.
But
why
now
are we
I want us to talk
that?
About
it triggered. Yeah. Yes. It triggered a lot of anger from the population.
True.
It from triggered. People.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that's what I wanted to now focus on, like okay. the outcome mm-hmm. of the uprising. 23 people, according to Amnesty International mm-hmm. or Amnesty West and Central Africa. So mm-hmm. the director of Amnesty, Samira Dawood, made a statement to summarize mm-hmm. Amnesty International's, you know, statement. Samira Dawood mm-hmm. highlighted five main violations mm-hmm. that has been going on, but that was especially noticed during the uprising. Number one mm-hmm. was arbitrary detentions. So mm-hmm. journalists, protesters, mm-hmm. politicians, members of the opposition, especially PASTEF folks, hundreds of them, I'm saying hundreds, have been arrested. Some are in prison and others are being electronically monitored. But she also mentions excessive use of force and that they counted 23 fatalities and essentially all of them were shot and killed by the police, meaning that the police has been using live rounds against protesters. But she also mentioned the presence of armed civilians. So those are the Nervi that we were talking about. So these are armed civilians, armed by people who are either in the government or pro-regime people. So they have very sophisticated equipment, firearms, pickups, right? And we know for a fact that the opposition in Senegal doesn't have a lot of money to provide that kind of equipment to people. Like, we're talking about dozens of pickups and, you know, firearms. Mm-hmm. And I listened to Maître Moussa Diop last night, mm-hmm. who was talking mm-hmm. about having evidence. Moussa Diop used to be very close to Macky Sall until they had the fallout a few years ago. And he said he has evidence of weapons that were purchased by the palace. Mm-hmm. And as we know in Senegal, the palace does not have that prerogative to buy weapons. So who was ordering those weapons? For whom? Where are they? Are those weapons in the hands of these militias or the Nervi? So those are questions that we don't have answers to. But Maître Moussa Diop said that also in that interview, it was on ITV, that he has constituted a pool of lawyers and they are investigating and bringing those evidence documents to court here mm-hmm. and outside of Senegal mm-hmm. to clarify why those weapons. She also mentioned, Samira Dawood, silencing of the media and the people by cutting mm-hmm. the internet. Because mm-hmm. for the first time in Senegalese history, we've seen the internet shut down, completely shut down, mobile internet especially, mm-hmm. completely shut down for days. In 2021, it happened, but it did not last that long. Right. Mm-hmm. But in 2023, last week, it took a very long time and it affected the economy pretty badly mm-hmm. because people could not withdraw money, especially the fact that it happened, meaning the trial and the verdict came out on June 1st, which is the end of the month. A lot of people got paid. They needed to go get their salaries, use their bank card, and the internet was completely shut down. So for days, they could not withdraw money. And it affected families, it affected the economy pretty badly. You also have corporations or businesses like Wave, the money transfer company. Their business was very much affected. People could not, and today in Senegal, people make a lot of transactions using Wave. They don't carry cash anymore. Many people don't carry cash. They pay with their phones. They use Wave. So they couldn't buy things at all. They couldn't pay for things, right? So you also mentioned earlier the silencing of Walfadri, a media group that tends to be very rebellious vis-a-vis the government. It didn't start with Macky. They were like that during Wad, even during Diouf. Okay? So these are things that we saw that unfolded during the uprising. And today, like you mentioned, FVENCAT, which is a coalition of civil society organizations and political parties, they were banned from peacefully protesting at Obelisk Square. And tomorrow, you mentioned that because I saw a statement that said tomorrow's protest was not allowed either.
But I would like to come back a little bit to the report.
Yes.
If you allow me. Okay.
Of course.
So Amnesty International, especially the West and Central African office, is asking for an independent investigation. Like I explained earlier, a lot of work has been done debunking every fake news online. And all those proofs were also sent under request to remember Maître Branco, who is the French lawyer
to Sonko.
Exactly. So he, even if he's not allowed to enter the country from the last trial, he has a very much still attention. He still has his attention on the case and has requested evidence to share evidence with him. And all that collection, plus other people collecting for their embassies, the Senegalese, not the Senegalese, but if you are of another citizenship, they went and told their authorities. You know what I mean? People were just trying to find all the ways possible to talk about Senegal. You understand? And Amnesty is the latest one to give a report on this to talk about. Red Cross did, I think, mention all the injured and the killed, but Amnesty is the one with the clear, with the latest numbers. And like you say, according to them, 23 people died, Dakar, Ziguinchor, mostly. And some were shot dead on the spot. Others were found dead after they were arrested, you know. So families were interviewed, people they knew were interviewed, et cetera, et cetera. And again, people on their own took up their videos, their cell phones, and just videoed a testimony, you know, and shared with the world. So all that put together shows clear evidence of violent demonstrations. Also, it kind of shed light on who is responsible for that. Because you mentioned the militia groups, civilians with weapons. There is no way those weapons could have been given to civilians if there was no trace of it. And hence the investigation that needs to be done. You know, the silencing of the press. You know, basically everything we talked about to this moment was just summarized by Amnesty's report. And now we are at the stage where international attention is caught. I even did an interview on CNN, also did several others with BBC, you know, and just that's the English part. Other colleagues have done, and on Al Jazeera as well. Other local journalists have been given the floor to address the issue on, you know, on other platforms and so on. So basically, what we need to understand of this entire repression that's been taking place is that what we have not seen in Senegal is now taking place. Civilians with guns directly shooting under the eyes of the police forces.
At protesters.
Videos are here. At protesters. Videos are here. Investigation must go on. And I think the evidence is so clear that investigation will go on.
Yeah.
You know, and some responsibility will be found. When will that be found? We will see as time goes. But it's the first time that in Senegal, this level of threat and, you know, this cas de figure takes place, where civilians are literally armed and shoot at people who use, like I said on internet, on CNN, who use rocks. In certain areas, there are some videos where they use cocktail Molotov.
Molotov.
That is also seen, you know.
That's
true. And, you know, we're laughing at it because now the unfortunate side of all this is that, you know how we used to be so scared. I think Nicholas Hack, in his reporting last time on Al Jazeera, mentioned something very important. He said that there's the Senegalese saying in Wolof, which says that Senegalese people are afraid of blood. You know, it is true. It is very, very true back then. But now it's been so normalized. It's been so banal to see bloodshed, you know, to see people being killed under your eyes and just, or injured to a point where you see a lot of blood, that I watched this video where people were chasing the police forces with cocktail Molotov. Mm-hmm. And the people were just laughing in the video. Those filming it were actually happy, laughing at the violence that was taking place. And that was not Senegal. You know, for most cases, this very peaceful, stable country in West Africa. So that tells you the level of change that's been undertaking, you know, that's been taking place in Senegal for the past 2 years, because we need to take it all the way back to 2021.
Yeah, unfortunately.
The
other important element that needs to be mentioned is also the fact that, I mean, the policing is so abusive and so violent in itself that sometimes, you know, I mean, it pales compared to the violence of the protesters. Seriously. Because at the end of the day, like you said, these people only have rocks and, you know, sticks.
That's sometimes all they have.
Molotov cocktails. I mean, now you know, the term Molotov cocktail is the it should be the term of the year in Senegal. It's the most widespread term that people use. But also,
but you know,
the other thing is
watching.
Yeah.
People have joy watching that, but people are being arrested and sentenced to very heavy, given very heavy charges for those cocktail Molotov.
Yeah, very
Serigne
heavy
Barangay
sentences.
Is one of them.
Yeah.
You know, Serigne Barangay is accused of plotting those cocktail Molotov and organizing field strikes, protests.
Protests.
And whatnot. We just have this these strategies from both ends. Both the demonstrators, okay, and the police as well. Another very unfortunate part that we haven't mentioned is the human shields.
That's what I was about to say.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. You know, the human shields, it's clear in the videos that the young man and the younger person, the child actually, who were in the arms of, at the hands of the police forces, was not there at all in peace. You know, and that we could see rocks still coming towards him, towards both of them, from the people, from the demonstrators, until they realized that the police forces were having these people stand ahead just so that they could stop the rocks from coming to them. Because obviously, when people realized that these the young person and the young adult were at risk, they stopped throwing stones. We could see that in the video as well. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So this is extremely dangerous for the image of Senegal, who is one of the first countries. First of all, Senegal is one of the architectures of human rights drafting in Africa. You understand? And so all human rights mechanisms were pretty much signed and agreed on by the Senegalese government, the different governments that came through. So seeing this happen here is a clear show of just democratic setback, and restricting the right to information is another big problem, because whether it's local news or international news, restricting the right to journalists for sharing information is just a clear sign of, human rights violation on the population. Because obviously, if you want to hide what's going on, it's because something is actually taking place. You know what I mean? Whether it's arbitrary arrest, excessive use of force, human shields, like we mentioned, and just civilians being armed and shooting at the populations. So all that, if you don't want to show it, that's when you restrict the right to information, and that's when you arrest journalists, because you do not want that to happen.
Yeah.
And even if the investigation is going on, just seeing how the press is treated is a sign of something going on.
Yeah, I mean, it is clear that this government has violated so many basic human rights for its citizens. And the other interesting element is also we saw the presence of the army in the streets of Dakar mostly. For the most part, they were protecting certain public and private infrastructures, because again, protesters targeted French businesses. So Auchan, Total, Orange, were targeted. But they went beyond that this time, actually. I've seen small businesses being targeted. The university students set on fire segments of the law school and the school of journalism, SESTI.
If they attack the law department, it's because they don't believe in the justice system anymore. And if they attacked SESTI, it's because they don't trust the local news, who seemingly were very quiet at times when the news were to be out there.
It's interesting because when that whole thing was unfolding, I was watching TV, trying to see which TV was showing the images, and they were all airing religious programming and music. There's nothing wrong with that, but it was just interesting. The only one doing it was Wal Fajri, and the next minute they cut off the signal, right? But there's an interest. The other element is, in Gejawai, where I'm from, I went to, because since protest movements is part of my research, I went to talk to protesters. I went to a part of Gejawai where protesters were trying to attack and burn down the courthouse, which is between Gejawai and Pekin. And the current Minister of Interior Affairs, Antoine Jom, used to work at that courthouse. There. And they were dead set to burn down that courthouse, which is, again, they attacking now the symbols of justice slash injustice and, the partisan journalism. And that in itself is quite interesting.
Yeah. But, the partisan journalists that you just mentioned, I would like to, and again, honestly, I am not taking sides, but some truth has to come out of that experience. Watching local news showing something different than what was actually taking place. Overseeing West Africa and having monitored Burkina Faso, monitored Mali, monitored other countries where, civilians have experienced many state coups, etc. Whenever something bad happens, local news do not show it immediately. They just wait until the news at 8 p.m. or at 1 p.m. in order to talk about what happened. And usually it is from the communique, the official communique of the government. You see what I mean? So this is not a something that just happens to Senegal. Mm-hmm. It's almost everywhere where we've seen chaos take place, or where we've seen state coups take place. Before you reach or in order to reach the right information, you have to literally chase after people, call them in order to get the right information. But mm-hmm. it's not from the TV or the radio that you will get it. Or yeah. if you do have it, it's the official narrative. And it is late at night or during the official news, breaking news hour. You yeah. understand?
Yeah.
But coming back to that, it is mm-hmm. obvious seeing what Welf went through or is going through with all the signal cuts that obviously maybe other local news are reluctant
yeah.
you know, to show mm-hmm. something.
They don't want to be Welf. Yeah, they don't
yes,
want
to
be.
It takes a lot of willingness to do it in order to do it and face the consequences.
And courage.
Welf
yeah.
has, it takes courage. Welf has, and Welf is facing it. Mm-hmm. And the population is trying to protect Welf. And whenever that happens, again, Welf has a number of followers online that is far beyond the expectations when their signal is cut.
Yeah. And you know what is unfortunate is I just saw that they are actually going to sack some people who work at Welf because of the cuts they cannot, you know, afford.
Of course, yeah.
To pay their mm-hmm. employee, and that there is a campaign to mm-hmm. for 1 million Senegalese people to donate 1,000 CFA and mm-hmm. give Welf 1 billion CFA to save Welf from, you know, going under mm-hmm. or yeah. firing.
And that's also where the international press comes in place and comes into play. You know, not having the local press talk about what's happening. The international press is here to talk about it, and that's what they've done, you know. So I do not want to put the focus on why they did not do it. I want to put the focus on what would happen to them if they covered
it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Should they cover and face the signal cut, okay, and all the consequences that will come. You just mentioned employment, you know, being cut, you know, work being drastically reduced, et cetera, et cetera. Should they face that or should they face the reality of sanctions and just face it like Welf has? Maybe not every outlet can do that. I have no idea. But what I'm trying to say is there has been a very close connection between the limits of local news and the potential of civilians who are online and the power they have and the ability for them to reach out to the international press, especially with social media now, and just have everything out in the news for the world to see. In all truthfulness, I am sure that the limitation was also done. I'm not saying for everyone, but I do not want to focus on that. My focus is, what the right question to ask is, how limited is the local press in the practice of their journalism?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and avoid putting in the same box the journalist on his own, on their own, and the press house they belong to. Because yeah. if your editor says, don't write this or don't talk about this, unless you want to lose your job, there's nothing you can do about it.
True.
This
so,
is very interesting.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it is. We could talk about this, you know, for another 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And
exactly.
and unfortunately, we can't, you know. But mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The other interesting thing that I guess I will mention here before we conclude is that Macky Sall, President Macky Sall, has not made any statement yet. He has not addressed mm-hmm. The citizens yet about what happened, despite, you know, more than 24 people losing their lives and all the material damages that was sustained by public and private businesses. He still mm-hmm. hasn't spoken. So he went mm-hmm. to see the Khalif General de Mourid, the Caliph of the Mouridia. And mm-hmm. it is announced also that he might go to Tilawan and talk to the Caliph of the Tijaniyya. So uh-huh. generally, when things like this happen, you have religious leaders who will step in, even before it happens, who will step in and try to bring, you know, the diplomatic side. In 2020, when it happened, and this time also, he went to Touba. Now, what is interesting is there are reports out there from the local press that said that Macky Sall gave guarantees to the Khalif that he will not run for a third term, but instead he will request a 2-year extension on his current term so that he can finish some, you know, rebuild the country and finish some projects and stuff. These are reports. We don't know if they're accurate or not.
Exactly. So we have to be careful on
so
that.
So we have to be careful, and we'll wait and see until he comes out and make a public statement.
I think the only thing, if the only thing is to just wait for Macky Sall to say something, because he hasn't said anything about anything at all, whether third term or what's going on personally. I mean, not his spokespeople, but just him. An address to the nation. I think he plans to do it. That's what it is. Is said that he plans to speak to address the nation following the dialogue, the national dialogue that he initiated, and it which was launched.
The day before the verdict.
Yeah, the day before the verdict. You know, so that dialogue, the opposition party, some of the opposition party, do not. Approve of it. The populations, as expressed online, and the people I spoke with do not approve of it because they say that they cannot simply imagine a national dialogue without the presence of Ousmane Sonko, who is under illegal house arrest right now. But before even the verdict was out, the idea of having a national dialogue without the main opposition party present, without the release of all the people currently in detention, and without the justice cleared for the people who died from 2021, you know, without having a cleared sentencing of those who are accused of those crimes, etc., etc., and even just have answers to the death of, you know, some of the, you know, those two soldiers, etc. Just the whole list, is very long. So the opposition party, as well as those who support them, say that they cannot imagine a national dialogue unless all those boxes are ticked for democracy, for justice, and just to be on the clear side that from now on, this will not be repeated. So a national dialogue was launched the day before the verdict. There is a huge generational gap that we observed at that national dialogue. Most of the people who were there were in their 50s, late 50s, 60s, to even 70s, while the median age for the Senegalese population is 17.8, if I remember, or even, let's say, 18 years old or 19, you understand. So all that put together kind of brings just a difficulty to understand the steps that are being taken by the government in the process of bringing peace back in the country, you know. So, and the Khalif, like you said, that they're meeting, those very Khalif and their representatives came to the government and spoke about peace way before we got to this level.
They did.
Yes, we remember the Khalif of Kaulak, who expressly went to the palace to meet Macky Sall and discuss the issues, and was just given the answer of let's let the law handle the business. And now the law has handled it. There's no rape. There's no death threat. There's corruption of youth. People just don't have a clear understanding of what's happening. Are they sentencing Ousmane Sonko because he's guilty of something, or are they cutting him or trying to cut him because he is a real potential for the presidential elections in 2024? And those answers can only be cleared by the president himself.
Yeah.
Only Macky Sall can come out, address the nation, and say whether or not he's going to run for a third term. There has been some release of people in detention, but that goes simultaneously, okay, with more arrests. So you don't know if they're making efforts to release people or if they're arresting people more. You see what I mean? So the same, it's like a game that's just being played. One moment you feel, you understand or you observe some things taking place to bring peace back. The national dialogue, the release of all the young people that were arrested in the past few days with the presence of their parents, etc., etc. The respect of the law, the respect of human rights on that level, you know, being minors who are arrested, just like the adults, etc., etc., to just having the same voices for the opposition party arrested, you know, and just seeing all this unfolding, not releasing or allowing Ousmane Sonko to go on his own wherever he pleases, and his family as well. Just to not lean on those rumors that the Khalif of Touba has said anything about this case, but to just highlight something. Another news is circulating or rumored that Ousmane Sonko was offered the same possibility to meet with the Khalif, except that he is asked to go under the supervision of the police forces, which he refuses by saying that there is no way he will go under any other protection but his own. You understand? Yeah. So, but that's just, again, I do not want to step on that because I'm one of those people who talk about checking facts, and that's not confirmed yet. So I have no idea where that comes from or how that will unfold. All right. I'm saying is, Bamba, we can sit here and talk about this all day. At the end of 2 years, at the end of 2 years of doubt, uncertainty, death, strikes, angry population, frustration, protest, businesses closed, businesses completely disrupted, uprising, children not going to school or seeing their education, you know, disrupted over the past two years. At the end of all that, we see Adjissa, a woman who accused Ousmane Sonko of rape, being denied, what everything she said, and clearly being told that what she said were lies. You understand? And now what is to come of her? Only heaven knows. You understand? And what is the image that gives to women in Senegal and in the region, in West Africa, or even Africa, or the world, because everybody's watching. Everybody. What does that tell women, who actually are going through sexual assault? What does that tell them? Where are we going to go with that? How far have we come as a country to see children being used as human shields? How far have we come as a country to observe so many human rights violations take place in just a few days, to count more than 20 people die, you understand, in the arms of people we have not even identified yet, or the authorities have not identified yet, you understand? And all the fake news around, everything put together is just another series of uncertainty coming up until 2024. So that's how things are understood right now in Senegal, in the diaspora, for the people I spoke with. The feminists groups are completely silent, or silenced, I should say, now, because so many of them believed in Adjissa and fought for Adjissa to see this debunked, legally, and just giving another narrative to what might have happened between Adjissa and Ousmane Sonko. What is to become of the fight for women? That's my main question. You know, the whole silencing of the press is just a question of time, because the press is not silenceable, if I can say that, the way that it is said. If you cut their signal, they will come online and have more people follow them.
Yeah.
That's it.
All right. So, and on that, we will conclude on that. Normally, I would ask the fun questions. Top three places, top three dishes, top three novels, but we did that on the previous
last time,
on part one and part two. So thank you very much, Borsotal, for coming on the podcast and talking to me about the current uprising in Senegal. It's always a pleasure to speak with you, and I hope that you will come back either on this podcast or on the Africanist to talk more about the situation as it develops. Thank you
very much, Bamba. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, and on that note, this was Bamba for the Ufahamu Africa podcast, and I will give you rendezvous for another installment on social protests and social movements in Africa. In the meantime, stay safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Ufahamu Africa. You can find more episodes, show notes, and transcripts on our website, ufahamuafrica.com. This podcast is produced and managed by Megan DeMint, with help from production assistants Chukwufunanya Ikechukwu, Alex Kozak, and Ami Tamaklo. Our non-resident podcast fellows are Bamba Njaye, Maseke Rioba, Takono Priscilla Sempere, and Kamohelo Tunigo Toledi. We are generously supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and receive research assistance from Cornell University and the University of California, Riverside. Our music is courtesy of Kevin McLeod. Until next week, Safiri Salama.